This is the Bible Book Club. I'm Susan.
And I'm Heather.
And we're in the book of 2 Samuel.
Welcome to the club.
Well, in chapters 2 and 3 of 2 Samuel, David began his reign by praying about whether it was time or not to start, and even the details of which city he should start in. God answered Hebron, which is where Abraham started with the promise from God of land for the nation his people would one day become. But not everyone was on board with God's plan. Abner was not on board, so he appointed Saul's only remaining son, Ish-bosheth, king over most of Israel. Joab and Abner start a civil war. Then Abner kills Joab's beloved fleet-footed brother Asahel. The war for Joab becomes personal, and his intent is to avenge the blood of his brother. Then, in a startling move, Abner switches teams. He asks to join Team David and promises to bring the other tribes with him. Well, David makes peace with him, hoping to reunite Israel as one nation. But not everyone is on board now with David's plan.
Joab is definitely not on board, and I don't know if I can blame him too much. Joab, remember, is the commander of David's army. Abner is the commander of Ish-bosheth's army, Saul's former army. Abner killed Joab's brother. How could David expect Joab to trust Abner and welcome him with open arms? Remember, aside from killing Joab's beloved brother, Abner is adept at political manipulation. Abner has been trying to kill David, because he was Saul's commander, for over a decade. Now, Joab has been by David's side for over a decade, trying to avoid being killed by Abner and Saul. So how could David trust Abner? How could Joab trust him? Why would David invite this snake into his house? And who would Abner most likely to strike first in the case that he is being deceptive? Of course, it would be Joab, because Joab is protecting David.
I mean, that's a whole bunch of family mess.
I know. At this point, I totally understand why Joab is not going to be happy about this invitation to Abner to switch sides. All right, so here we have it. Scene 1, Joab wants bloody justice. Chapter 3 continued.
In verse 24, so Joab went to the king and said, "What have you done? Look, Abner came to you. Why did you let him go? Now he's gone. You know Abner, son of Ner. He came to deceive you and observe your movements to find out everything you're doing." Joab then left David and sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the cistern at Sarah. But David did not know it. Now, when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside into an inner chamber, as if to speak to him privately, and there, to avenge the blood of his brother Asahel, Joab stabbed him in the stomach, and he died.
All right, there's so much commentary about this, because a lot of evil is going down here, and there are many angles in this bloody mess regarding motive, and who is right, and who is wrong. So first, let's talk about Abner. We will never know what the true motive of Abner's heart was, because he's dead. If he changed from Team Ish-bosheth to Team David just because he was annoyed with Ish-bosheth, then he did not have a godly change of heart. And if so, he could just as easily get frustrated with his treatment in David's house and turn on him too. In which case, maybe God was using Joab to protect David by killing Abner. We just don't know, because Abner's dead, so we don't know what he was going to do next. So what about Joab? First, here's where he's wrong. Hebron was a city of refuge. So to call Abner back and avenge his brother's blood by killing Abner in a city of refuge was wrong and a serious sin. Additionally, Asahel was killed in battle, you know, fair game, while Abner is killed by deception. So Joab's wrong in that area too. Second, to overrule the king's decision was wrong. No matter how threatened Joab felt, he should have discussed it more with David, but it clearly says he did not tell David that he told Abner to come back. Okay. And then there's David. Now, Was he wrong or was he right? David demonstrated a lack of consideration for Joab in this decision. It was already well established that there was a rivalry between Abner and Joab. Abner, as Saul's commander, had been chasing David and Joab for over a decade. So, of course, there's, you know, a rivalry there. Then Abner appoints Ishbosheth, rejecting David. So Abner kind of showed his colors there. Then Abner kills Joab's brother. Joab was still at this time grieving for Asahel. So David's decision to bring Abner into his army lacks a certain kind of sensitivity and wisdom. It was also well established that Abner was a great commander with a lot of standing in Israel. David did not make it clear in his decision what Abner's role would be. Would he report to Joab or vice versa? And even if he did report to Joab, Abner was a political climber and he was going to challenge Joab from the get-go every chance he got. David could have discussed the situation with Joab before committing to allow Abner into their army. David, the young king, was sorely in need of a course on change management.
Yeah, it was kind of a leadership fail there.
This is yet another weakness we will find in David. Perhaps he has an aversion for confrontation. Because David is going to demonstrate a lack of consideration again in the future with his own sons. He will make some decisions without considering how his actions will affect others and without discussing with them first and listening to their concerns. Okay, scene two. David forces a show of repentance.
Verse 28. Later, when David heard about this, he said, "I and my kingdom are forever innocent before the Lord concerning the blood of Abner, son of Ner. May his blood fall on the head of Joab and on his whole family. May Joab's family never be without someone who has a running sore or leprosy, or who leans on a crutch, or who falls by the sword, or who lacks food. Joab and his brother Abishai murdered Abner because he had killed their brother Asahel in the battle at Gibeon." Then David said to Joab and all the people with him, "Tear your clothes and put on sackcloth and walk in mourning in front of Abner."
So here's how David reacts to Joab's murder. First, David claims his innocence before all of Israel, because remember, this could divide the nation that just came together. Then David curses the house of Joab five ways with sores, leprosy, lameness, murder, and hunger. Pretty bad. Then David forces the people of Judah and Joab to mourn for Abner publicly. Now, Joab must have complied as if he were sorry for what he had done, but again, we don't know his heart. So was he just acting? Okay, so take note of what he did to Joab, because David's going to act differently to a couple other murders in the future. Scene three, David seeks peace through public relations. David's next move is wise as a leader. He mourns for Abner. He really is sad that this happened so that all Israel can see that he did not condone Abner's murder. David is trying to reconcile and unite these two kingdoms, and it has not been easy. And he's trying to bring peace to Israel. And so it was important for those loyal to Abner, all those Israelites in the north, to see his true grief.
Continuing in verse 31, King David himself walked behind the bier. They buried Abner in Hebron, and the king wept aloud at Abner's tomb. All the people wept also. The king sang this lament for Abner: "Should Abner have died as the lawless die? Your hands were not bound, your feet were not fettered. You fell as one falls before the wicked, and all the people wept over him again." Then they all came and urged David to eat something while it was still day. But David took an oath, saying, "May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if I taste bread or anything else before the sun sets." All the people took note and were pleased. Indeed, everything the king did pleased them. So on that day, all the people there and all Israel knew that the king had no part in the murder of Abner, son of Ner. Then the king said to his men, "Do you not realize that a commander and a great man has fallen in Israel this day? And today, though I am the anointed king, I am weak, and those sons of Zariah are too strong for me. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil deeds.
So all the people, implying all the people of Israel, north and south, are pleased that the new king is not showing partiality to Joab. But I couldn't help feeling bad for poor David, because if it's not one thing, it's another. And he just can't seem to catch a break. And I wish he still had that gentle Jonathan in his life to kind of guide him and bring him back to the Lord in this, because instead, all he has is Joab, who's a son of Zariah. And these sons and their strong desire to avenge the blood of their brother are too strong for David. All David can do is force Joab to mourn for Abner publicly. But it doesn't sound like David has any delusions that Joab regrets his actions. And we will see in 1 Kings chapter 2 that David realized that he was too gentle to manage Joab, for he charges Solomon to deal with Joab in the end. And Solomon doesn't hesitate. Scene 4, more blood, more conspiracy.
Chapter 4. When Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, heard that Abner had died in Hebron, he lost courage, and all Israel became alarmed. Now, Saul's son had two men who were leaders of raiding bands. One was named Baana and the other Rechab. They were sons of Rimmon the Beerothite from the tribe of Benjamin. Beerothites considered part of Benjamin because the people of Beeroth fled to Gittim and have resided there as foreigners to this day.
Ish-bosheth may be king, but Abner is the one in charge in northern Israel. And when the people hear he is dead, the people panic. I am sure they were wondering if David and company were on their way to attack and who would lead their army with Abner dead. Two of the men in Ish-bosheth's army, Baana and Rechab, hatch a plan. But before we learn of it, the author interrupts the story to introduce Mephibosheth.
Verse 4. Jonathan, son of Saul, had a son who was lame in both feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. His nurse picked him up and fled, but as she hurried to leave, he fell and became disabled. His name was Mephibosheth.
Mephibosheth is Jonathan's son. By introducing him here, the author is making a point, because in the next paragraph, spoiler alert, Ish-bosheth is going to die. The author is giving us a heads up that there is still an heir to the throne, Jonathan's son, which creates a difficult situation. Normally, when the crown is acquired rather than inherited, the new family kills all of the old family to make sure the crown isn't taken back. It's for this reason that poor Mephibosheth is crippled. He fell, fleeing in fear with his nurse from David when the word reached his nurse that Saul and Jonathan had been killed. But David promised Jonathan that he would spare his family, and David is going to keep that promise. Okay, after that interlude, we go back to our story of Rechab and Baana.
Verse 5. Now, Rechab and Baana, the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, set out for the house of Ish-bosheth, and they arrived there in the heat of day while he was taking his noonday rest. They went into the inner part of the house as if to get some wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. Then Rechab and his brother Baana slipped away. They had gone into the house while he was lying on the bed in his bedroom. After they stabbed and killed him, they cut off his head, taking it with them. They traveled all night by way of Arba.
Baana and Rechab, thinking they will gain favor with David and save themselves, kill their own king. The manner of the assassination is important. Killing a man while he is lying down was not an act of war, but of murder. Cutting off Ish-bosheth's head makes this death similar to Saul's death. Word of David's reaction to Saul's would-be killer, the Amalekite, must not have gotten around. Else Baana and Rechab would have known that killing is not the way to find favor with David. With the death of Ish-bosheth and Mephibosheth's inability to rule because he's crippled, the house of Saul comes to an end, just as Samuel predicted in 1 Samuel.
1 Samuel verse 13, "You have done a foolish thing," Samuel said to Saul. "You have not kept the command the Lord your God gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him ruler of his people because you have not kept the Lord's command."
Saul failed to understand that Israel's kings did not have the autonomy to make their own decisions like the godless kings of other cultures. The kings of Israel were to be more like viceroys under God. Saul was to reign over Israel as the representative of God. God was the true king of Israel. And therefore, for Saul to remain in his position, he must obey God. He did not. And the kingdom was taken from him and from his heirs. God knew that this would be the case, for it was always his plan that the ruler from whom the scepter would not depart was from the tribe of Judah, not the tribe of Benjamin, as Saul was. David would be the anointed one who accepts God's authority because he is a man after God's heart. And he points the way to another anointed king who accepts God's authority, the Son of Man, who is also the Son of God. Jesus will submit to God's will unto death on the cross for us.
And now back to our story in 2 Samuel chapter 4, verse 8. They brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron and said to the king, "Here is the head of Ishbosheth, son of Saul, your enemy who tried to kill you. This day the Lord has avenged my lord the king against Saul and his offspring." David answered Rechab and his brother Benah, the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, "As surely as the Lord lives, who has delivered me out of every trouble? When someone told me Saul is dead and thought he was bringing me good news, I seized him and put him to death in Ziklag. That was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more then, when wicked men have killed an innocent man in his own house and on his own bed, should I not now demand his blood from your hand and rid the earth of you?" So David gave an order to his men and they killed them. They cut off their hands and feet and hung the bodies by the pool of Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in Abner's tomb at Hebron.
What a bloody mess. Saul killed himself. David killed the Amalekite who said he killed Saul. Abner killed Asahel. Joab killed Abner. Baanah and Rechab killed Ishbosheth. And David killed Rechab and Baanah. It's a bloody mess when you consider that, with the exception of the Amalekite who claimed to kill Saul but didn't, they are all from brother tribes and one family. None are righteous. David tries to keep the peace and attempts to heal the nation. He honored Saul and death and the men of Jabesh Gilead. He diplomatically negotiated talks with Abner. He even asks for his wife, Michal, Saul's daughter, back in his negotiations with Abner. But he failed to deal with Joab well, perhaps because Joab was family, his nephew, or as he said, Joab was just too strong for him. And he failed to be fair. David punished Rechab and Baanah with death, which is a stark contrast to Joab's simple punishment for the same crime. Joab simply had to pretend to mourn his victim and was cursed.
They're really taking this eye for an eye thing very seriously.
Very seriously. In some cases. Another, David was a little easy on Joab, it seems. All right, scene 5, the two kingdoms become one.
Chapter 5, all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "We are your own flesh and blood. In the past, while Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel on their military campaigns. And the Lord said to you, 'You will shepherd my people Israel, and you will become their ruler.' When all the elders of Israel had come to King David at Hebron, the king made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel.
So all the tribes of Israel get together and their elders, and they come together at Hebron, and they recognize they have no king, they have no military leader. The family feud is over, and they acknowledge their kinship and David's role in their history as a nation. God has clearly made David the king. So a covenant between the two factions is made, and David is once again anointed in a public ceremony, this time over all 12 tribes and not just Judah. It was a huge moment for David and for Israel. And it appears that Israel is finally beginning to understand what an ideal leader king looked like. An ideal king of God is chosen and anointed by God, is an Israelite, loves the Lord, leads Israel in battles against their enemies, and shepherds the people. And even more specifically, in Deuteronomy 17, Moses outlined what a leader king should look like.
Verse 14, when you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you and have taken possession of it and settled in it, and you say, let us set a king over us like all the nations around us, be sure to appoint over you a king the Lord your God chooses. He must be from among your fellow Israelites. Do not place a foreigner over you, one who is not an Israelite. The king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them, for the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives, or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. When he takes the throne of his kingdom, he is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law, taken from that of the Levitical priests. It is to be with him, and he is to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees, and not consider himself better than his fellow Israelites, and turn from the law or to the right or to the left, then he and his descendants will reign a long time over his kingdom in Israel.
David fits almost all of the requirements, but he's not perfect. And the part about wives is a concern that will grow in our next episode. I'm not sure how he overlooked that one. And carefully following all of the words of the law is also going to become fatal in the next episode.
Now back to our story in 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 4. David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. And in Jerusalem, he reigned over all Israel and Judah 33 years.
David became king of all Israel. It was a messy climb to the throne because David's mission was messy, just as our mission today is often messy, because life is messy and has been since the fall in Genesis and will be until Jesus comes again and the world is restored to what was lost in the Garden of Eden. This is one of the greatest struggles of being a Christian. The mess kind of just surprises us. It's a common belief that if we just pray really hard, God's gonna make it all fit into this beautiful image we have of how our life should look like. What we forget is that we are not on a quest for beauty. We are on a crusade for Christ. It's a daily battle with the world. Yes, there is joy, but often in the midst, there are seasons of tribulation.
What you're talking about is kind of making me think of a Natalie Grant song, and it's talking about how, about how God never promised that we would have a perfect life, but he just promised that he was going to be there through it all.
But we have this picture of God that if we pray, it's going to be beautiful, and that's not really living for the Lord.
Yeah, it's not. He's going to be there to hold us through it.
Right.
But it might still be messy, just like David's story was.
Exactly. David's appointment as king over all Israel was the fulfillment of prophecy, and that's why this uniting of the kingdom was such a big deal. The prophecy and promise to Abraham and Sarah that kings will descend from them and that Canaan would be theirs occurred in Genesis 17, season 1, episode 16. Listen to this first prophecy.
I will make you very fruitful. I will make nations of you, and kings will come from you. I will establish my covenant as an everlasting covenant between me and you and your descendants after you for the generations to come, to be your God and the God of your descendants after you. The whole land of Canaan, where you now reside as a foreigner, manner, I will give as an everlasting possession to you and your descendants after you, and I will be their God."
David's appointment to king was also a fulfillment of the prophecy made by Jacob and the blessing he gave to his sons before he died in Genesis 49, season 1, episode 36, that the kings would come from the tribe of Judah until the Messiah ruled over all nations. David was the first of that line.
"The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he to whom it belongs shall come, and the obedience of the nation shall be his."
And lastly, Naomi's prophecy in Ruth 4, season 8, episode 4, that Ruth's son would become famous. That famous birth would be Christ via David, the son of Jesse, the son of Boaz, the husband of Ruth.
"So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The woman said to Naomi, 'Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth.' Then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. The woman living there said, 'Naomi has a son,' and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David."
And David became famous. David fulfilled all these prophecies from the past, but his rise to king at this point in our story also points to the future, because David is a foreshadowing of the prophecy of a king to come. His descendant will be the long-awaited Messiah.
And I think that's one of the reasons that everybody was so confused about Jesus. They really expected him to be a king like David was a king and lead them to greatness. Instead, he didn't look like that, and he wasn't leading them into battle.
No, not at all. And now, with all Israel under his authority, it is time for David to position Israel as the nation that God intended from the beginning, so that all the world would know of God. This was so important, for this is the purpose for our greater story, the Bible. The Bible was written so that all may know that God is the one true God who will provide the way for our salvation. God said so to Moses in Exodus 9.
Verse 13, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Get up early in the morning, confront Pharaoh, and say to him, This is what the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, says. Let my people go so that they may worship me, or this time I will send the full force of my plagues against you and against your officials and your people, so you may know that there is no one like me in all the earth."
Then Solomon said the same thing in 1 Kings 8.
Verse 59, "And may these words of mine, which I have prayed before the Lord, be near to the Lord our God day and night, that he may uphold the cause of his servant and the cause of his people Israel according to each day's need, so that all the peoples of all the earth may know that the Lord is God and that there is no other."
Then the psalmist said so in Psalm 67.
"May God be gracious to us and bless us, and make his face shine upon us, so that your ways may be known on earth, your salvation among all nations."
And Nebuchadnezzar said so in Daniel 4.
Verse 17, "The decision is announced by messengers. The holy ones declare the verdict, so that the living may know that the Most High is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and gives them to anyone he wishes and sets over them the lowliest of people."
And David said so in Psalm 145.
Verse 9, "The Lord is good to all. He has compassion on all he has made. All your works praise you, Lord. Your faithful people extol you. They tell of the glory of your kingdom and speak of your might, so that all people may know of your mighty acts and the glorious splendor of your kingdom. Your kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and your dominion endures through all generations."
And Isaiah in chapter 43 said this.
Verse 10, "You are my witnesses, declares the Lord, and my servant whom I have chosen, so that you may know and believe me and understand that I am he. Before me, no God was formed, nor will there be one after me. I, even I, am the Lord, and apart from me, there is no Savior. I have revealed and saved and proclaimed, I, and not some foreign God among you. You are my witnesses, declares the Lord, that I am God. Yes, and from ancient days, I am he.
Then Jesus himself said this in John 10,
verse 37, do not believe me unless I do the works of my Father. But if I do them, even though you do not believe me, believe the works, that you may know and understand that the Father is in me and I in the Father.
Then Jesus prayed so in John 17,
verse 20, my prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. May they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. I have given them glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one. I in them and you in me, so that they may be brought to complete unity. Then the world will know that you sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me. Father, I want those you have given me to be with me where I am and to see my glory, the glory you have given me because you loved me before the creation of the world. Righteous Father, though the world does not know you, I know you, and they know that you've sent me. I have made you known to them and will continue to make you known in order that the love you have for me may be in them and that I myself may be in them.
And Paul said so in Colossians 2.
Verse 2. My goal is that they may be encouraged in heart and united in love so that they may have the full riches of complete understanding in order that they may know the mystery of God, namely Christ.
That was a lot of verses, but I hope you heard over and over and over again. God's desire throughout time and throughout the Bible has been that you may know him, his plan, his word, his spirit, his son.
And we will put all of those verses in the show notes if you want to go back and read them and meditate on them so that you too can know the one true God of the Israelites and of us, Jesus. What's a club without friends? If you're enjoying the Bible Book Club, why don't you share it? And then you can say,
welcome to the club.
New episodes drop every Monday, and get all episodes now on Amazon Music. As always, head over to susanmee.com/Bible Book Club for show notes from today's episode. Bible Book Club is hosted by Susan Merrill and Heather Rubio, edited by Buck Buchanan, produced by Haley Mawat.